Some brands offer you low finance, or cashback, or servicing.
Renault don't do ors. We do ands. The Renault Kadjar, with 1.91% APR and €1,000 cashback and 3 years servicing, saving you thousands. Renault, the brand with the ands. Visit your local Renault dealer. Finance is made under a hire purchase agreement. Terms and conditions apply. Deposit required, subject to lending criteria. See Renault.ie.
Golf Smarter Premium number 475, published on February 10, 2015. Ben Hogan Golf Clubs are back with CEO Terry Kaler.
This is Golf Smarter.
Welcome back to the Golf Smarter podcast, Terry.
Yeah, it's nice to be back, Brett. Obviously, our world has been a little busy the last few weeks.
I wanted to hear all the trumpets making the announcement that Terry Kaler is back for his grand announcement. Wow, it's been an amazing couple of months for you guys.
Well, it really has, and we were at the PGA show 2 weeks ago and making the formal official introduction of Ben Hogan is back, Precision is back, and the response to what we've done from all over the world has been just phenomenal.
Well, what I want to do, the way I want to structure this morning is I want to talk about the PGA show, about your presentation, about the demos, and what the reaction was. Then I also want to talk about things that you, if you even had a chance to walk around the PGA show and see what else was out there, what other things were being introduced or things that intrigued you. And then I want to talk about finally we can talk about the new Ben Hogan Golf brand of irons that you are introducing.
Well, to answer your question, I did not get out of our exhibit booth at all except to go grab very quick bites to eat and take a few breaks, but we were just completely snowed. The media was all over us, the golf pros from everywhere, international people. So that 1,500 square feet that we lived in for 3 days was pretty much my world. I didn't really get out at all.
Okay, well, I'll cross that off the list. That's done. So let's then get right to it about your anticipation. I really want to walk you through from step to step to step of your entire week down there and what happened and what the reaction was.
Well, you know, on kind of the 30,000 foot view, as they said, as people say, what was really overwhelming and humbling and inspiring was the just huge number of golf professionals and even industry people that we did know from, you know, all of us have been around it for a long time, but people we didn't even know coming up and just sincerely saying, I know you're busy. I just want to thank you for bringing Ben Hogan back to golf. And we heard that dozens and dozens and dozens, maybe hundreds of times.
It's so interesting.
All of us did. So it was, you know, made us, this brand has, it's not just a golf club brand. I mean, they're Mr. Hogan, the legacy he built, the company he built. It was a real treasure of the golf industry and the golf world to a lot of people, not everybody, but to a lot of people. And so it was very gratifying to be welcomed back so, you know, overwhelmingly.
It's interesting because I think that when on a business side, when you and your partners and your investors and us, we're all considering, you know, what it means to score, total pun intended, to score the Ben Hogan name and the brand, to bring that back, what it could mean to the company financially. But I don't know if you could actually have computed what it means to the golf world emotionally.
No, and when that starts with all of us, I mean, you know, this is not just a company. It's not just a brand. I mean, you know, what we talk about is this is a man's life we're talking about here. This is a man's legacy we hold in our hand. And that's a huge opportunity, as you mentioned, but it's also a massive responsibility that all of us feel. I mean, I think I've told you, we have over 130 years of experience of people that worked with Mr. Hogan, that worked at the Hogan Company dating all the way back to 1970. So, you know, that's 40 plus years ago, people that were side by side with him in the early days. And then in the real heyday of the late 80s, when the Hogan Edge was one of the hottest irons on the market, and before the company went through, you know, kind of, we call them the dark years, but, you know, got misdirected by owners that really didn't share that deep affection and devotion to Mr. Hogan's principles and values.
Mm. And it means so much. And, you know, I've watched a lot of the videos of you being interviewed down there, and it seems it amazes me how emotional it is for so many people, and what it means to so many people to have that name back on in golf.
Well, I'm blown away by it. And so are we, Fred. I mean, as we move this company, and of course, the very first decision we made when we saw this coming was this company needs to be based in Fort Worth, not down in Victoria, South Texas, where we built Score. This company is a new company. This is a new venture. This is a new entity, but it's kind of the 60-year-old startup in a lot of ways. So that's kind of a hard thing to get your hands around. But as we came back to Fort Worth and when we announced all this in May and when we started doing some of our preliminary work before that of finding locations and everything, the Fort Worth community, the golf community here, and the business community here really has embraced the return of Ben Hogan as a Fort Worth institution, not just as a golf industry institution. So it's been, again, I use the word humbling, flattering. I don't know the word to describe how it makes us all feel to be able to do something like this.
Phenomenal. So tell me about the process while you were down there. I mean, people knew that something was going to be announced. People knew that new clubs. What was the anticipation? And then tell me about the presentation.
Well, the anticipation was, you know, we tried to go in without any real goals and objectives. I think, you know, as we mature, you get to go to Orlando and you have your goals, your objectives of how many new accounts or how many dollars or whatever. But we were in there saying, hey, this is a coming out. We're really surprising this. We did a remarkably good job in our industry of not letting anyone see the product until that morning of the 20th when we went into the demo day. We had location. We could not have asked for better. I mean, the main gate into demo day, when you came down the sidewalk after you came in the main gate, you were pointed right at Ben Hogan's space on the driving range there. Mm. So we had anticipated a lot of interest in that. We had secured a pretty sizable space there. We had about 13 hitting stations, and the gates opened at 9 o'clock, and by 9:02 we had everyone standing in line at these hitting stations to hit the Ben Hogan. So, you know, that kind of verified that we're not the only ones happy to bring this back. And then the reaction to the product, this is an engagement. This is, you're on the driving range hitting Ben Hogan's for the first time in some years. And the engagement was overwhelmingly positive. We have a remarkable product here that we're very proud of. And kind of skipping around, this is kind of such a big picture, but through the course of the whole show, what was really gratifying too was the golf professionals that were former Hogan staff pros, people that were former Hogan employees and sales representatives and whatever, coming up and saying, Mr. Hogan to really be proud of this. And that was like the big payoff, you know, to people Mr. Hogan to be proud of it.
So there was no formal on stage introduction type of thing. It was just open the gates, demo day, come on out and hit the clubs.
Yeah. We show up and the crowds are there. And so we were covered up solid, you know, the entire 9 to 5 period. In fact, you know, a lot of companies, you know, they've been at demo day for years. These guys are, you know, it's work. It's a lot of work being out there on your feet, you know, for 9 hours. And, you know, at 4:45, we look around the driving range, and this is a huge driving range at Orange County National, but it's like 600 yards across. It's a big donut. And there's a lot of people out there, but other companies were tearing their tents down to people. And I don't think we started to tear down till almost 6 o'clock, and the show, the thing was technically over at 5, but we had people still standing in line wanting to hit golf balls. And we finally had to quit when the facility wasn't giving us any more golf balls and we couldn't pirate any from anybody else. And finally it was like, sorry, we don't have any more golf balls, everybody. So guys were running out into the range and picking up close shots that people had hit, little pitch shots, and running back and hitting 3 balls. It was pretty inspiring.
And are these, this is the press or this is the public? I've not been to a PGA show in Orlando, so I'm not sure. Is this open to everybody and anybody, or are these people that you need to impress?
Well, first of all, you need to do that next year, Fred. You need to come see the PGA show, and we'll give you, and then you'll be like a kid in a candy store. You think what you do is fun, wait till you go do that thing. But the PGA show.
All the way on the other side of the country for me, it's not an easy one to get to.
You wouldn't be the only person from California.
That's true, but I'd be the only one paying for myself. That's the problem.
So the PGA show is really, it's for golf professionals, the retail trade. You know, it's a trade event. Mm-hmm. On demo day, you know, of course, the golf media is there. It is a worldwide exhibition. It is the big industry show worldwide. So, you know, we were covered up with international distributors wanting to know what we're going to do in Korea and Southeast Asia and Australia and Western Europe, UK, South Africa, wherever. But it is the industry extravaganza for the world, and it's not open to the general public. I think that there are quite a few people that kind of slip in at demo day and into the show that are guests of their PGA Pro, you know, good members and board members that tell the pro, I want to go to Orlando. I want to go see this big carnival. But for the most part, it is a trade event. It is PGA professionals and retailers and international people.
And across the board, the reaction from, and now I'm fascinated about industry people and retail. Those are two, they have to complement one another, obviously. But was the reaction, well, give me some of the, and I want a broad spectrum of reaction. Of course, I'm talking to the CEO of the company and all I'm expecting you to say is everyone loved it. But I really would love to get some insight onto the broad spectrum of what the reaction was.
Well, I think from the, I'll take it by segment. The PGA community was very grateful to see the brand back. You know, in its heyday, the 70s, 80s, in the early 90s, Ben Hogan Company, under Mr. Hogan's direction, really created a persona for itself of a dignified organization. And it had dignified policies and the most extraordinary sales organization out there. It was just kind of an air about the Ben Hogan Company that was not stuffy at all. It was just, this company does it right, to put it in very simple terms. So there was and as you know, you've covered it and you've talked about it, the industry has been kind of grappling for what it really is. And there's been some business practices that, and you know, as retail distribution blew up with all the big retail stores, there was a lot of deal making and terms and short product life cycles. And, you know, to us, a lot of people in the industry are tired of that. But if you've built your company on that, it's kind of hard to just change it. And the fact that we have this fresh slate, clean piece of paper, so to speak, to recreate the business practices along with the products and the way we do business. And kind of our brand essence is to be dignified. Mr. Hogan was a very dignified man, and that's kind of the guide that we have, the talisman that we have to hold up to.
What's interesting to me is when you talk about what the Ben Hogan brand used to be and people being excited that it's back, and you were saying in the like 60s and 70s, I guess, is when the Ben Hogan golf brand was at its peak, correct?
Well, all the way into the very early 90s, before the company was sold and moved to Richmond, Virginia.
But the peak of because it kind of probably just faded away, and that's why it all disappeared for a while.
After that move, yes, it began the decline. But up until then, if you go to the late 80s and 90s, the three hottest irons in the market were the Hogan Edge, the Tommy Armour 845, and the Ping I2. And depending on what month it was, which one of those was the best-selling golf club was really more about who could keep up with their demand. But those three clubs really defined the irons category in the late 80s and 90s. And so when, you know, Tommy Armour did whatever they did, Ping I2, you know, gave way to a new model after a few years, and Hogan moved out of Fort Worth and changed the whole personality of the company and moved to Richmond, Virginia, and went off a different path. But so by the late 60s and early 70s, Ben Hogan Company was the number one brand at green grass level. You know, it was McGregor and Spalding and Wilson, and all those companies had broader distribution. And the Hogan Company really resisted the off-course movement that kind of started in the late 70s, early 80s. It resisted it for a long time. And then eventually caught up. But the company was always highly regarded at the green grass. It took very good care of golf professionals. It was a very revered brand in that respect. When the Edge came out, by that time, Ben Hogan is distributed in all serious golf retail establishments, like most of the other major brands. But Ben Hogan was one of the top brands in golf at that time, and stacked right alongside, you know, in its categories, right alongside Titleist and Callaway and, you know, the other major brands. So, you know, when it went down that other path after the move to Virginia and subsequent sale to Spalding and then the Callaway, you know, it was, I mean, Mr. Hogan was no longer in the picture. So I think there was some of that guidance and inspiration that was lost maybe, or, you know, I mean, I'm not going to pick on anybody. It went down a different path than what it had always built its core business on.
Another thing that happened in the late 70s, early 80s that could have had an impact was the marketing and the socialization of brands and people wearing brands. You know, I mean, like, where would Nike be without a Michael Jordan, right? I mean, and then the marketing and the official brand of, you know, start, what was that, the 84 Olympics, when all of a sudden sponsors were getting their names to be the official beer of, right, of the Olympics, or the official shoe type of thing. So in those days, before, you know, people, it became important for people to wear, you know, the brand on their shirt. They were probably just wearing their country club name on their shirt. So now you're up against a whole different mountain there on the marketing side versus just the quality of the product side. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, I know. I think so. And, you know, I think most people in our industry view one of the pivotal things in the golf equipment industry was when Callaway went public. They were the first company to go public. And so they raised this big war chest, and Eli Callaway was a very smart marketer and really understood consumers and marketing. And so they became kind of this marketing juggernaut. And Callaway had this phenomenal growth through the 90s, but they drove that with very, aggressive tour tactics, very aggressive advertising tactics. Aggressive meaning just bigger spending than anybody mm-hmm. in golf had ever mm-hmm. done. And Callaway, when you really get into it, and TaylorMade a little bit before them, was with the original Metalwoods, was kind of the beginning of selling a golf club based on features and benefits. If you go back into, and I'm old enough to remember the 50s and the 60s, and people, you know, I'm a McGregor guy, or I'm a Wilson guy, South Texas, you know, I'm a Hogan guy by my heritage. But you kind of had this brand that you were pretty loyal to. I don't think people jumped around maybe as much. And you know, one company went over here saying, hey, my driver is better, my iron is better. It was pretty much kind of brand driven, but on a very small scale from a spending standpoint. And then we entered the era of performance-driven claims, starting, I guess, really the TaylorMade, the original TaylorMade Tour Preferred, you know, the original Metalwood was kind of the first real product that came out going, look at me, I work better than the other guys. And that's what, you know, you're talking about the branding, but what really was driven by the last 30 years or so of golf was driven by, you know, Ping and then Callaway, TaylorMade, and then Callaway talking about performance, you know, and then Smalling Top Flight got into it with the ball, you know, changing the way the ball is made. The Top Flight Strata was a huge impactful golf ball in changing golf ball technology from wound to solid, which, I mean, nobody's made a wound golf ball now in, what, 12, 15 years. But so the golfers out there, to me, the golfers out there, he hadn't really changed, he or she. They're looking for value, which means performance for my dollars. And I can like your brand all I want, but if the other guy over there is making a better product, you know, whether it's a car brand or a golf club brand or a fly rod or shotgun or whatever, I can have my brand loyalties, but if my brand is getting blown away on the technology front, I eventually have to leave my brand.
Quality of brand is one thing, but getting people to play your product in a high-profile situation, like tour players, also enhances brand exposure. So my thought would be relevance. I mean, to the young audience who, you know, you talked about loyalty to brands, and that generally happens to an older demographic, but to a younger demographic, you're hoping to go after them and introduce them to something that they will be hooked on so that they will carry it on through their adult years and then not change brands. How do you take a name like Ben Hogan and make it relevant to a younger demographic? I mean, you keep talking about all these people. Oh, well, we're so glad you're back. We're so glad. See, they knew about it initially. Now you have to introduce it to an entirely new audience and make it relevant to them. How are you able to do that?
Well, you know, one of the big surprises of the show was we felt exactly like what you just stated, that, you know, our initial market shares will come from the older generation that had a more of affinity and maybe nostalgic or maybe, you know, whatever. For the Ben Hogan brand, and we'll give it a look probably quicker. But it was really interesting to us how many of these young young people that are going through the PGM programs around the country to study to become golf professionals. How many, you know, sub 30-year-old golfers came up and said, "Wow, Hogan, that's so cool. It's back." You know, my dad gave me a set of Hogan's, my first clubs, or my granddad did. And granted, these younger generations have been pounded with a lot of brand messages from other brands, but we were really inspired by how many young people really look up. And I think it's because, you know, Ben Hogan's Five Lessons is still the best-selling instruction book of all time. It's kind of your study guide for the golf swing. If you're going to go in that direction with your life and become a golf professional, it's, you know, one of your core study guides. And these young people, you know, whether you're 25 or 65, Fred, you still want to play better golf. You want to hit it longer. You want to hit it closer to the hole. You want to make more putts and shoot lower scores. I mean, that doesn't change based on your age or anything. And, you know, our story is all about precision is back. Our story is about, you know, this distance thing is great. Distance is fine. But some of the things that we're chasing, the technologies that are emerging in the pursuit of this relentless pursuit of distance, we've seen in our testing, they are compromising the precision of a golf club. And we launched this whole company. If you look at our videos, it's about precision is back. And our focus is on, how do I give you the most precise shot-making tool possible without sacrificing distance, without sacrificing forgiveness? But we're all about, you know, if you're and I are playing golf together and we're playing a scramble and somebody hits a drive down there 145, all four of us are going to hit a shot from 145. And this guy says, "Well, you know, I have a 160. Mine went 160. That makes me better." No, it doesn't. It needed to go 145. And we've kind of lost, I think, the focus on that precision. Mr. Hogan personified it in the way he played the game, the way he did business. But it really is all about, I mean, the shot length thing is all showing. It's about strokes gained tee to green is where the action is. Are you hitting greens? Or are you hitting it closer to the hole? And nobody cares whether you're 142. Nobody cares what club you hit. Did you make it go 142 and fly the way you wanted it to and land close to the hole and stay there? That's really what golf is about. It's about hitting it from where you are to where you want it to be.
I quoted you the other day when I said, you know, when we used it as the title of an episode long time ago. Give me 10 feet closer over 10 yards farther any day of the week.
Exactly. And that's where the game is played. And, you know, I watch, excuse me, I watch the young golfers and they all hit it long. I mean, between the equipment and the physical training and just bigger athletes coming in the game, more aggressive swings, they all hit it long. But, you know, and I've watched the PGA Tour players and how brutally far they hit the ball. But then I look at the PGA Tour and the leader hits 2 out of 3 greens. Mr. Hogan would have gone home for a month if he'd have played 1 round 2 out of 3 greens, much less a career of it. You know, and so, you know, those greens weren't as good. And one of the famous or more favorite quotes is, Mr. Hogan apparently early in his career was lamenting about not making more birdies, and Mrs. Hogan apparently supposedly told him in the hotel room or over dinner, said, "Well, why don't you hit it closer then?" Well, that's pretty simple, right? Because if you think about the greens those guys putted on back in the 40s and 50s when Mr. Hogan was in his heyday of his career, you know, the fastest greens in the country back then were somewhere well under 10 on the stimp meter. Even Oakmont, which was the fastest greens in the country, was like 9.5, 9.8 back in the 60s when the USGA adopted the stimp meter. Well, now the Muni course down there that's kind of ragged has 9.5 to 10 stimp greens. Mm-hmm. You know, the tour guys put 11s and 12s that are like pool tables. And, you know, you read about these guys that, you know, Tiger Woods, you know, or whoever didn't miss a 4-footer all last year. Well, in Hogan's day, you didn't get through a tournament without missing a 4-footer because the greens weren't that good.
Right.
So if you were going to shoot those 63s and 4s and 5s like they did, it was because you were putting it all over the hole and you were giving yourself a lot of 8, 10, 12, 15-foot looks because you didn't make a lot of 25 and 30s like they do now.
All right, well, let's talk about the clubs. Well, let's get in the detail of the clubs. Let's talk about... to start, the Fort Worth 15 irons. Is that what they're called?
That Fort Worth 15 is our first iron. And so what we introduced 2 weeks ago is a line of irons called Fort Worth 15 and a line of wedges called TK 15. And the Fort Worth 15 irons, the design objective there was to create a golf club that didn't give up one thing to a good muscle back blade, to a golfer that wants to shape the ball, to a golfer that wants the feel and the performance of a blade, to not give up one thing to that golf club, and to improve the forgiveness of that blade type golf club. But also to go to that golfer who's kind of the fringe player, the 8 to 15, who may have been told for his whole life, you're not good enough to play blades. He reads that. He talks about that. And that may very well be true if you're looking at classic muscle back blade. But we wanted to create a golf club that golfer who can hit it somewhere around the middle two-thirds of the face most of the time can optimize their distance control and their precision. And we've done this exceedingly well with this golf club. It is everything. For your listeners out there that, you know, romance about the Hogan Apex, which was the number one blade in golf for many, many years. This club doesn't give up one thing to any Apex in history, but it kind of blends a lot of what the Hogan Edge brought to the table, which is, okay, you didn't hit that one perfect. You still got away with it, but you also got the feedback to know, I hit that a little on the toe. I got away with it, but I learned something also. And a lot of, to me, the rap on my critique of a lot of the quote game improvement golf clubs is they help you get away with some misses. And I'll add, not as good as you might think, but they help you get away with some misses, but you didn't get the feedback you needed to know that was a little on the toe. That was a little low in the face. That was a little high in the face. You have to have feedback if you're going to continue to try to improve your ball striking. Everybody wants to be a better ball striker.
Sure. Sure. So I'm one of those guys, that 8 to 15 that you're referring to. I've only played cavity backs. I'm playing a Mizuno cavity back iron now. My wedges are score wedges still. After trying everybody else, I put my score wedges back. But so I've always had a cavity back and been actually, you're right, I was terrified of having a blade iron. It even took me a long time to get from a graphite shaft to a more flexible metal shaft, but eventually it all helped my game. Why should I seriously consider that this is going to be a game improvement for me to not have the cavity back, not have those that little extra help there?
Well, first of all, we've tested a lot of the thin face cavity back technologies against our golf club. Mm-hmm. And we found that perimeter weighting, as we have all learned it, may not be exactly what we've been told it is. Mm. And, you know, the trend of this industry has been to try to move the weight as far from the center of the face, as far to the perimeter, with even using tungsten weighting, to get this weight out around the perimeter of the golf club. Well, to me, that's kind of like turning a hammer on its side and trying to drive a nail. The weight now is away from the impact point, so you lose some efficiency of impact. I mean, that makes sense, right? I mean, a hammer, it's the same hammer, but it doesn't drive a nail near as well sideways as it does using it properly. Because the mass, you have to have mass to have strike efficiency. We use the term smash factor. You know, you want that ball coming off the club as consistently as possible. What we learned is in our robotic testing, and one of the things about the irons is you notice we don't use numbers on the bottom iron, 6, 7, 8, 9, P. Those are gone in the Hogan world. Every club is marked with the loft of that golf club. And we make every club in the irons from 20 to 47 degrees.
And that was all, I'm guessing that's all inspired by the way you created the score 4161.
Well, the score 4161 was inspired by what I saw happening 20 years ago in irons of the number on the bottom of club losing its meaning. So, for example, in the PGA show 2 weeks ago, irons with a number 6 on the bottom ranged from 26 to 33 degrees. In that show. So what's a 6-iron? Okay, of course the 26-degree 6-iron goes further than a 28 or a 30 because it's 2 degrees stronger. Of course it's going to go further. Or it's a 3/4 of an inch longer. Of course it's going to go further. So what we said, look, what is the golf club? You're standing in the fairway. What you have in your hand is a combination of length and loft more than technology. It's a combination of length and loft. If you have a pure blade golf club, it's going to be able to do things the cavity back won't, but it's going to give you a different feel and give you the ability to flight the ball differently. What we believe is golfers are trying to hit real golf shots. They're trying to flight the ball down. They're trying to take a little off because how often do you get to your ball in the fairway and go, that's a textbook 8-iron, that's a textbook 7, that's a textbook 4. It almost always, regardless of your handicap or tour player, it's not quite just a textbook something. I need to pull a few yards off, or I need to turn this over a little bit to chase it to the back of the green. And we learned mid-handicap golfers are trying to do this, are trying to hit golf shots. So what we set out to do is give you a club that's forgiving. If you hit it out past the end of the scoring lines, nobody makes a golf club you're going to get away with that. If you lay the sod over it, or if you hit it in the eyebrows, it's going to be a bad shot with our club or anybody else's. What we said is if you can hit it around the center two-thirds of the face, the primary striking area, how can we make each of those shots in a course of a round or a month or a lifetime be as consistent as possible from shot to shot to shot? Nobody hits it dead in the same spot every time. No tour player, no anybody. And what we learned in our testing, particularly in the middle lofts and high lofts, the 30s and the 40s and even up in the 50s, kind of where score was addressing, is the smash factor on conventional wedges and thin face cavity back irons, the smash factor varies a lot around that center two-thirds of the face. We set out to try to give you a consistent smash factor. So the shot a little high on the face goes more like the one hit solid. The shot a little toward the toe goes more like the one hit solid. And we accomplished that. Our club is tested extraordinarily forgiving against any of the, quote, game improvement clubs, much more so than any blade. But it's responsive to what you want to do with the golf ball. Flight it down, take a few yards off, this kind of thing.
So how do we know which number to pick?
Well, if you went and bought a new set of irons, how would you know which number to pick? They're going to go different than your other irons.
Yeah, right. I mean, do I always want a little extra yards, a couple extra yards, like you were saying, that it's if you take 2 degrees extra, you're gonna get those yards? Or so how would I know now that I have a choice? It's like the adjustable driver heads to me. It's for the average golfer, to me, doesn't make a lot of sense. Just get it adjusted once and stop messing with it because you're going to screw yourself up. So how do I know which is the right one for me and to stay with that's the one I should be choosing?
We're going to take you through a process called Hogan Fit, which we're finalizing now. It's a very complex set of algorithms and databases and knowledge and interrogation with you. We're going to take you through this Hogan Fit process, and we're going to look at your current bag, and we're going to map your golf bag for you to look at, you know, how many clubs you have for long range, middle range, and short range. And most golfers have too many clubs at the long end of their set, and they don't have enough distance separation because of this loft compression. The 6-iron gets pushed further and further down in loft, but the 3-iron doesn't move, so you get loft compression. You're going to go through Hogan Fit. We're going to reach a prescription that gaps you off of your highest lofted hybrid that you like to carry. It's going to gap you to the highest lofted wedge you like to carry, and it's going to rearrange those distance differentials. And we're going to output for you, here's your recommended distance chart. These are your lofts that we're going to give you the best separation from club to club to club, where as you get down your higher lofted clubs, you're going to have more and more distance consistency, a smaller gapping, if you will. And then we're going to print you out a little cheat sheet, if you will, that you carry with you in a little wallet in your pocket that says, you know, I'm 165. Okay, that's my 27. Or that's my 25, or
good,
that's my deal. You're going to have a cheat sheet for your set. And then just like learning any of your other yardages, you know, in your current set, for example, your 140, you know, that's a soft 7 or whatever. You know these things about your set because you've been playing them for a while.
Right.
If you went out tomorrow and said, I'm going to go get some new technology, I'm going to go get a set of irons. As I mentioned, that new set of irons, the 6-iron, may be anywhere from 26 to 33 degrees. Mm. You've got to learn all new numbers anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But why not relate the number to 29 on the bottom of the club versus 6 on the bottom of the club?
Right, right.
You're going to very quickly learn, I'm 145, you know, that's a soft 32. That's what you know it is, because you know that is a 32-degree golf club at this length, and you know what you can do with it. And more importantly, when you want to hit that little soft 32, the 5 or 6 yards you wanted to come off of that shot are really going to come off of the shot. And what happens so often with modern technologies is, you ease up a little bit, you hit it flush, you catch the hot spot in the face, and it goes as far as it would have if you'd hit it hard. And you go, well, wow, that 8-iron went 15 yards longer than I wanted it to. And if the drive goes 15 yards longer, you're happy. But if the approach shot's 15 yards longer, it just plugged under the lip of the back bunker, went in the creek behind the green, or the gunch behind number 12 at Augusta. Because you don't want an iron doing anything but going how far you have. It's precision. It doesn't matter whether you're playing in that scramble, there's four guys getting ready to hit a shot from 145, and the big strong A player hits a pitching wedge, and he may flare it right or lay it over, hit it over the green or whatever. But if the 22 handicapper on the team pulls a 5-wood from 145 and hits it up 8 feet from the hole, you're going to use that shot, right? Nobody cared that he did it with a 5-wood instead of an 8-iron or a 9-iron or whatever. There's room in those little boxes for a number, no descriptions.
Well, it took me a while with the score golf. It took me a while because the one that confused me the most was the 41 and 45 going, it's like, oh, that's a 9-iron, that's a pitching wedge. It took me a while. I got it right now, but it did. I made a lot of mistakes. So I see this being an adjustment, but I like the idea of giving me more precision, knowing what I'm going after. So you have those irons now, but you also, are you reintroducing a completely different design on your wedges versus what you had at Score Golf?
Yeah, absolutely. There's let me preface this, but there is a whole lot of Hogan Apex in Score Golf. Where that whole design came from was a wedge I found on eBay that was a Ben Hogan special, and I had never seen the golf club. And I've got a pretty extensive Hogan collection. I've always been a believer that the Hogan Apex was a very different kind of blade, and it was special. It did things. I played a lot of them. I played a lot of different golf clubs. The Hogan Apex did things other clubs didn't do, particularly in the mid to high lofts. And it was very forgiving out on the toe compared to any other blade, and it had more consistent performance high in the face. So I picked up this Hogan Special wedge. It was 51 degrees, and it was just unbelievable how good this golf club was. So the Score Golf Club came a lot from that particular Hogan Special wedge I picked up. That was a 1960s-something model. We believe it was 67 to 69 in there. And so there was a whole lot of that. Every designer of anything, whether it's houses or cars or, software or golf clubs, everything you do is a culmination of what you've learned up to that point. And I learned a lot about golf clubs from being at the Ben Hogan Company and working with those guys and from Joe Powell down in Florida. So the Score wedges were a culmination of everything I had learned up to 2009-10 when I designed that golf club. This new golf club is everything I learned up to then, plus what I've learned in the last 5 years. But the new Hogan wedges, people who are familiar with Score, which some of your listeners are, might see some Score influence in it, probably will. People who are Hogan, longtime Hogan fans are going to see a whole lot of Ben Hogan in that golf club. But this line of wedges is built around one very simple premise, and that is distance control. It is all about distance control. And whether you're a tour player or a 15 handicapper, we were just talking about, if you're 90 yards or 82 or 105 or 107, that's a magic number. I want it to go exactly that far, and I want to get away with it if it's a little high in the face because it's in the rough, or I hit it a little heavy, or I hit it on the toe a little bit. I still want it to go as close to that target yardage as I possibly can because that's how far I am. That's the challenge I have in front of me.
And the name TK15, where did TK come from? Huh?
Well,
who's the king? The king. That's what it is, right?
Well, that was the guys in the shop. I give them that. I've never really felt like I needed to put my name on a golf club, and I've designed a lot of clubs in my day, and I've never put my own initials on the club. But
I've noticed
we have kind of a democracy there. It's an imperial democracy. I tell the guys, everybody gets a vote, and then I get decided if I like the vote. But everybody kind of said
it's the golden rule, right? He who has the gold makes the rules.
but we have a brilliant team of people, and they all kind of said, hey, here's what's going on the wedge. I said, no, I don't want to do that. And they said, no, this is going on there. And so this is, you drove this, and we talked about that for all the golf clubs. I said, no, the wedges need a different name than the irons, even though they flow beautifully together. And we honored the irons with the Fort Worth 15 designation. It's the first Hogan iron produced in Fort Worth in many, many years, and 2015 is the year it was brought out. So, but we did agree the wedges needed a different name because the wedges can blend with any kind of irons out there. They happen to blend beautifully with this iron, but they'll blend with every other iron we ever make. But so the TK15 is, I gave in.
Oh, well, that's actually a very nice legacy.
It was flattering. I mean,
have
it
your
is
initials
flattering.
There. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Mr. Hogan said one time that it was not important to me to have my name on the golf club. It's only important that it be the best we can make. And that's kind of inspiring that even he wasn't that big about having his name on the golf club.
Sure. Sure. What about where we can find them? Is it online only or is it going to be available retail? And when are they going to be available?
We're building up to full production. We're moving into a whole new facility, you know, typical construction thing. We're a little behind on that. We're bringing in inventories, trying to get enough inventories in place. This is a very difficult club to make. The foundry that makes our golf club heads is doing a beautiful job of them, but it's going slower than they thought. We'll be beginning to have limited deliveries into the marketplace, hopefully by the end of March, and ramping up through April, May, and into June. And from what we see, Hogan's going to be a little hard to get for the first half of this year, but you know, we're moving as fast as we can to move into production, but it's always about the quality first. And, you know, the legacy, one of the legacy stories of Hogan is that, you know, that they destroyed the first $100,000 worth of golf clubs that the company made because they didn't meet Mr. Hogan's standards. So we didn't want to repeat that, but if we'd had to, we would have. You know, we're being very, very picky about the quality of this golf club because that's sure. what it's supposed to be.
Right, right. You have to be. It's better to have your consumer wait a little bit longer than putting out something a little too early, right? Getting reamed by the press.
Well, and the consumers. Everybody that takes delivery of a set of Hogans is going to be blissfully happy. It's an extraordinary product. We heard nothing but rave reviews. And you know what was interesting about the every loft thing, when we're going in, this is a radical departure from irons. We make 44 golf clubs from 20 to 63 degrees. We can feel the exact gapping for any body, regardless of their skill set, their distance profile, and we take all that into account when we prescribe your loft matrix. But 44 golf clubs, we make a 20 and a 21 and a 22 and a 37 and a 45 and all the way out to 63 degrees. So it's infinite precision. I mean, it's the ultimate commitment to precision.
So does that mean that every set that somebody buys or every time somebody purchases, they have to go through a customization process? Or are retailers going to be able to keep enough inventory?
There will not be inventory on the shelf. This is a custom golf club company. We believe it is absolutely senseless to spend $1,100 or $1,200 or $1,300, $900, whatever you're going to spend on a set of irons, and just buy them off the rack. If there's any part of the game that's precision, it's this part. Mr. Hogan believed in it. We believe in it. So our whole company is being built. It is a custom golf club company.
Mm. So. Mm. Oh, wow. And price points? We haven't talked about that.
The irons are $149 a club. The wedges and irons are both $149 a club with steel, $164 with graphite. So you know what it gives us the flexibility to do here is to, you know, how many irons do you need in your bag? If you're a strong profile player and you carry one fairway wood and a hybrid and then a putter, you have a room for 10 irons and wedges. If you're a slower swing profile person, maybe you hit a 5 wood 160, really don't need but about 6 or 7 clubs to your highest lofted wedge because your gaps are going to be too close. And so we can build 4-degree gaps, 5-degree gaps, 6-degree gaps. We can build you the precise set of golf clubs to fit your strength profile, your launch profile, which nobody's ever been able to build your set of irons to fit. Are you a high ball hitter, a low ball hitter, medium? We can fit your launch profile as well. So doing every golf club gives us the ultimate inflexibility to build your set, Fred, which will look different than my set, which will look different than the tour player set, which will look different than your wife's set, your grandfather's set. I mean, everybody gets a set of golf clubs that's precisely calibrated to what their strength profile and launch angle is.
So when can we start making orders? Is not until the end of March, or can we start putting in orders now?
We will, the Hogan Fit process, we're working out the final bugs. People will be able to start going through Hogan Fit early next week. They can then have an opportunity to save their prescription. They'll have the opportunity to save their prescription, but also ask for priority on scheduling and production. So they can tell us, you know, hey, that was fun, I'm kicking tires, or that was fun, when can I get some? Mm-hmm. And we will be back to them with production scheduling because right now, you know, there are thousands of people wanting sets of Hogans, and there are not thousands of sets of Hogans going into production tomorrow. So we'll be beginning to build in mid to late March and take care of our trade accounts. We'll be setting up Hogan fitting centers around the country at private clubs and daily fees and municipal courses, probably some select off course. But, you know, we had 3,000 accounts wanted the Hogans, and you know we don't have the first account set up yet. So you know we've got to grow to that. We're a growing thing.
But when you said available next week, you're talking about like Valentine's Day or March 1st, mid February, yep. March 1st. Is that?
We're going to start allowing people into Hogan Fit by the middle to the end of next week, maybe sooner, and they can see what their prescription looks like. They'll be able to tell us whether they really want to order or whether they're still kicking tires. we'll be getting back to them by mid to late March, starting to say, we can give you a production date of April 10 or April 20 or April 30. It will be late May to June before really we're really in the thousands of clubs a day. And I mean, we're not a big company. We're not a Callaway or a Titleist. We don't have a factory already set up when we launched this. We don't have a history of building, you know, thousands of golf clubs a day. And but our director of production operations, Steve Dreyer, ran the Hogan factory from 1986 till the last Hogans were made in America in the mid 2000s. So he knows how to make Hogans better than anybody. And awesome. he will tell us how many we can build the right way, because he still remembers Mr. Hogan coming in and picking the tiniest little thing apart in the golf club. And so that what shaped Steve in the mid to late 80s. So he carries that to this day. It's very important to him whose name is on that golf club and the obligation we have.
So it's kind of like the Steve Jobs type of perfection on every product before it goes out the door.
You know, I mean, I don't know Steve Jobs. I saw they sold 75 million iPhones the last quarter. So I don't think we'll ever sell 75 million golf clubs in a quarter. But
darn,
we will make as many golf clubs as we can make the right way. And we will grow and we'll grow and we'll grow to whatever the market says.
Yeah,
tell this demand. Is how many Hogans we want collectively.
All right, Terry, I have to make a couple of announcements real quick. But when we come back, can we wrap it up with one tip from you?
Absolutely.
Great, thanks. Well, let me talk to these people for just a moment. I've got some pretty great news for our members-only subscribers. If all goes according to schedule, by next episode, you will be a premium access subscriber. The great news is that you don't have to do a thing about it. The folks at Libsyn have agreed to port everyone's account into premium access. You will be given a month of premium at no charge, with the option of a 6-month subscription at 50% off. And we also offer a 12-month subscription, which is the best value overall. But at this time, there's no discount available. Not only are those three choices of 1 month, 6 month, or 12 month available with premium access, you also get regular extras like wallpapers for your phone, videos, and, of course, access to every episode in the Golf Smarter library. And that includes an updated directory to the archives. Now, up next, we'll continue our look at what was special from this year's PGA Merchandise Show. Last week, I took about a 90-minute drive out to Sacramento to sit down with TJ Gillen from Titleist before he gave a big presentation about the all-new Pro V1 and Pro V1X. Sure, he's a sales rep, but I promise that I will grind him. Other than ad budgets, what sets Titleist balls apart from the competition? Who, what kind of player should be playing these balls? And how do we figure out which of the Titleist balls, and there are, what, 5 different brands, which one is best for our game? And, of course, the issue that has perplexed me for years, what the hell does Pro V1 mean anyway if it's not provisional? If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please click on the email icon or the Hey Fred button. Oh, and one more thing. Who are you? This has been such a one-way conversation for so long. I would like to ask a favor. Could you please take a moment? I have a 5-question survey that won't tell me a ton, but it will give me a better overall picture of the entire Golf Smarter community. Click on the survey link at either golfsmarter.com or today's blog post at golfsmarter.libsyn.com. Libsyn is LIBSYN, golfsmarter.libsyn.com. Okay, Terry, why don't you slide over in front of the fireplace for a moment and bring your computer with you, and let's wrap this up with a tip about how we can hit more greens with our mid-irons.
Well, you know, that's something that's really dear to our heart is watching people struggle with iron play, and there's no secret, and the shot link is all proven. Hitting more greens is the secret to lower scores. I mean, I don't care how good your short game is, a 40-foot putt is easier than a 40-foot chip or a pitch or a bunker shot. And whether you're a tour player or whether you're an average amateur, you're going to be better with a putter in your hand. And one of my favorite stories is Mr. Hogan apparently in his career was lamenting, you know, not making enough birdies. And Mrs. Hogan supposedly said, well, then why don't you hit it closer? Well, that's kind of inarguable, right? So, you know, when I look at iron play, what I see golfers doing is trying to hit the ball too hard with their irons. And I'll draw this comparison for you. Mr. Hogan's book, 1949 book, Power Golf, he listed all of his yardages. And now granted, you know, lofts and links were all off, but the thing that revealed most about that was he would list a regular yardage for an iron and then his maximum. And through his entire set, his maximum was 25 yards longer than what he considered regular, which means he was hitting very controlled, softer iron shots as a matter of routine, but he could amp it up when he had to hit it hard and far and high. And that may be why he was noted for hitting 16, 17, 18 greens in a round. I know in the 1960 U.S. Open at 48 years old, Mr. Hogan hit the first 34 greens in regulation on a U.S. Open golf course at Cherry Hills. You know, you don't see that kind of ball control on the tour today, but and the tour leader hits two out of three greens. I think Mr. Hogan would have gone home for a week if he'd had one round hitting two out of three, much less a career. But and these guys are good. I'm not saying these guys aren't good, but I watch amateurs and pros just go at their irons so hard, and you're not going to be as consistent with it. It's not a driver. It's an iron. It is designed to go a specific distance and with the highest degree of confidence and regularity that you can. And I'll kind of add this. We've done about 40,000 golfer interviews through our online fitting process. And we found that the average recreational golfer across all handicaps, we asked them, how far do you hit a comfortable 8-iron? How far do you hit a maximum 8-iron? And it's averages about 7 yards different. Mr. Hogan's was 25. There may be a real clue there to why you don't hit more greens if you're a recreational player, or a tour player for that matter. But a controlled iron shot is just a much easier shot to hit solid and get consistent distance control. So my irons play tip today is don't hit it so darn hard, guys.